from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Millions of Americans take personality tests every year, in school, in therapy, applying for a job, even in custody battles now. The tests have become the ultimate tool for measuring the immeasurable, how you'll fit in, how aggressive you'll be, how driven, which life path best suits you, how creative you'll be in following it. Now comes the pushback. New warnings that too much emphasis is being laid on this soft and subjective science. Personality testing is everywhere in American life, and it is having a significant impact on important life decisions. Has it gone too far? Tonight on Point, America's love affair with personality testing and a charge that it's gone too far. Have you taken a personality test? What did it tell you about yourself? What did it tell your employer about you? Did it really capture the person that is you? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Annie Murphy-Paul, author of the new book, The Cult of Personality, How Personality Tests Are Leading Us to Miseducate Our Children, Mismanage Our Companies, and Misunderstand Ourselves. Annie Murphy-Paul, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Also from New York, Malcolm Gladwell, New Yorker writer, author of The Tipping Point, and admirer of Ms. Murphy-Paul's work, who's been doing some personality testing of his own. Malcolm Gladwell, wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Oh, thank you.
Annie Murphy-Paul, your book's making quite a splash, and I guess that's not to be that's not surprising in a world where it seems like everybody has taken, is taking, will take personality tests. How pervasive is personality testing in America today, and what's your problem with it?
Well, they're surprisingly pervasive. I mean, I think we spend a lot of time thinking and talking about intelligence tests, aptitude tests like the SAT, high-stakes testing in our schools, but a lot of us aren't aware that actually personality testing is very widespread, too. And I think a lot of us have dismissed personality tests as harmless, frivolous fun, and sometimes they are, but sometimes very important life decisions ride on these tests. And if that's the case, we should be sure that these tests are scientifically valid and reliable. We should make sure that they don't invade people's privacy, and we should make sure that they're not labeling complicated people with one-dimensional labels. And unfortunately, that's exactly what personality tests do.
Okay, a lot of people have taken these. Some people may not have. Perhaps many listeners won't know the range of tests. What are you talking about when you say personality tests? What's the range? What's the type of test? What's produced when a person sits down to take these tests?
Well, unlike those other tests I mentioned, intelligence tests or aptitude tests, personality tests are looking at the whole individual. They're saying, what are you like? Who are you? And that's part of the problem. I think they try to take on too much to try to describe a whole human being with a test. So the category of personality tests is very broad. It ranges from the Rorschach inkblot test, which I think a lot of us will be familiar with, to tests like the Myers-Briggs, which is the test which gives you a four-part, four-letter personality type like INTJ or ENFP, to tests like the MMPI, which is a longer clinical personality test which has lots of very strange questions which people might encounter if they are aspiring to be a police officer or a paramedic or a psychologist.
Because it gets into your ethics.
Because it's looking for various kinds of pathology that might get in the way of you doing a good job. Mm-hmm. And finally, another kind of personality test that people might have encountered is the so-called integrity or honesty test, which is given a lot in fields like security services and retail sales. And that's supposed to tell whether a person will lie or cheat or steal on the job. So there's such a wide variety of personality tests, and they're used in so many ways that it's really quite a large category.
Malcolm Gladwell, you've read this book and expressed some pretty strong admiration for it, and you've been doing some personality testing of your own. You're the tipping point master. Are we tipping into permanent the thrall of permanent personality testing mania, or are we tipping away from it here?
Well, I think that one of the things that attracted me to Annie's book is that it's one of the first signs that we're developing, I think, some much-needed skepticism about these tests, that we have been embracing them far too eagerly and have been far too accepting of their claims. And I think that this is the beginning of the backlash, and it's long overdue.
Why do you think, Malcolm Gladwell, that Americans are so drawn to these tests? Of course, many are now required to take them by an employer, a prospective employer, even a court in a custody battle. But an awful lot of Americans, as Annie says, have gone out themselves and done this out of curiosity or something more. What's the attraction?
Well, there's a kind of fundamental human desire to be able to sum up either our friends or ourselves or our employees. I mean, it's irresistible in a certain way. I mean, even though I share Annie's skepticism about these things, I went out and got myself tested in various ways, and it's, you know, it's tremendous fun, and it's fascinating, and, you know, you desperately want to be able to say, I'm this or I'm that, because it's a way of making ourselves seem understandable and explainable. But it's just important to keep in mind that, you know, much as we may want to be able to sum up our friends in two or three phrases, or ourselves in two or three phrases, it can't be done. We're just much more complicated than that.
Annie Murphy-Paul, you're saying that, and this isn't just parlor game fun that might be distracting. You're saying it's more seriously a problem for individuals and institutions than that. Make that case. How does this really become a problem? At what point?
It becomes a problem at the point when life decisions, important decisions like, are you going to get a job? Are you going to be awarded custody of your children? Are you going to be paroled? Are you going to be released from jail? When these questions, when the answers to these questions ride in part on the results of a personality test, that's when we need to look closely, more closely at these instruments. And also when the scientific literature is telling us that a lot of these tests aren't valid, meaning they don't measure what they claim to measure, and they aren't reliable, which is science's word for a test that delivers consistent results. So when you have important decisions riding on very flawed instruments, I think that's when personality testing becomes a real problem that we need to look at.
And give us a very specific example of how companies use this in particular to screen employees. Is it a significant part of their screening, or how important are these tests for hiring?
Well, one recent survey reported that 30% of American companies administer personality tests to their to prospective employees. They're used quite frequently in other settings that you mentioned, custody battles, parole decisions. So to go back to what I mentioned earlier, the integrity tests, those are given to approximately 5 million people, Americans, each year, and are administered by 6,000 American organizations. So they're very widely used.
And companies are looking for what? They say, well, here's an opening we have. We want an introvert or an extrovert or a thinker or a judger. Is it that specific? How are they using personality tests? If it's not to test to test for, I don't know, some neurosis, but rather for just general type.
Well, different companies are certainly looking for different things. But in the case of those honesty tests, they're looking the proponents of the test claim that not only will they be able to tell you whether an employee, prospective employee, will lie or cheat or steal, but whether they'll be late for work, whether they'll engage in computer abuse, which is emailing and surfing the net on company time, whether they'll file a fraudulent workers' comp claim, whether they will become violent on the job. So they're claiming to predict very specific behaviors, and psychology isn't any better at predicting human behavior than any other field, where people would like to know what others will do in the future, and it's just a very imprecise art.
So you're saying they just don't work, or they work, but the company has no right to inquire about all that?
In some cases, they don't work, and in other cases, I think they do violate people's privacy. some tests are better than others, but I think in general, personality tests have been given a lot more credibility and a lot more authority than they deserve.
Annie Murphy-Paul, Malcolm Gladwell, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Dallas, Texas, L.D. Moran. He is president of Achievement Tech, a company that offers customized personality testing for businesses and individuals. L.D. Moran, thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
So this is your business. You must believe in it. What do you offer companies, and how well does it work?
It works very well. But to emphasize a couple of points earlier by your other guests, obviously it's important there are a lot of tests in America, and you have to be careful that you're getting a validated test. That's the seal of approval. It's outlined in the Federal Trade Commission, strict psychological procedures. There's a methodology that you have to employ to develop a non-discriminatory test. And when a company is purchasing a personality test, they should always ask for the documentation that substantiates that claim.
The message I'm hearing from Annie Murphy-Paul is that whatever the claim, it can't really be done. There's too much complexity in the human personality. What do you claim to be able to actually deliver an employer?
Well, first of all, we're not trying to judge people with these tests. As an employer, we're trying to establish a standard against which we can hire new people. And there are a number of legal and valid ways to establish those standards. But once they have standard and you assess somebody or put them through this testing procedure, you're then going to compare their results against that benchmark, which was established for your own company. We tell all of our clients, in fact, if you run one of our assessments, it says right under the score sheet, this information should not count more than a third of your overall hiring decision. There is no test that will tell you whom to hire for any job all by itself. This is simply a new and, I think, important tool for the HR toolkit. It fills a void that now exists. There are very few professional HR people who can sit down across the desk from me and examine me orally and tell me how competitive I am, how driven I am, how skeptical I am, all of the kinds of things that people look for, the intangibles, the subjective criteria, are only available through testing.
Malcolm Gladwell, here's a man who does this for a living. He says as long as it's validated, you need a way to sit down across the table and learn these things. The tests do it. What do you say?
I'm skeptical. I mean, I think it's nonsense, to be honest. There are certain things we can tell through tests, sure. But what's left out is so much more important than what is than what can be possibly be captured through some of these instruments. And the risks of using these instruments to reach conclusions about people are so great that we're clearly better off without them. I mean, there's a reason why most HR people can't sit across from somebody and tell whether they're competitive or ambitious or all those things, and that is that it's impossible to tell on the basis of a very brief encounter with someone what their personality is like. And giving them a paper and pencil test does not make that essential difficulty go away. And we have to at some point accept the fact that as human beings, we are extraordinarily complex, and our behavior differs dramatically from situation to situation. And that no amount of kind of validation, whatever that means, of a particular instrument, paper and pencil instrument, can escape this fundamental fact about who we are.
L.D. Moran, even so, you hear the skepticism, but it's your business, and a lot of businesses are signing up for what you're offering, I imagine.
Oh, they certainly are, and you'd be pretty impressed if I named off some of the ones that are using it. Most of your major corporations use testing, but there's several points here. Number one, it's going to be a far greater value in a smaller company than it is in a major company.
Okay.
You have to realize that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce tells us that 98% of the companies in America have less than 100 employees. Well, if you look at that 98%, you'll find out that probably at least half of those people do not have professional HR people in their company.
So for them to have a sense of who's coming through their doors, you're saying this is the way to go. On the other hand, we hear a wall of skepticism. We're going to dig into all this tonight. L.D. Moran at Achievement Tech in Dallas, Texas, thanks for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Annie Murphy-Paul, author of The Cult of Personality, and Malcolm Gladwell from The New Yorker, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. Listeners, have you taken a personality test once, twice, three times? What did it tell you about yourself? What did it tell your employer about yourself? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's love affair with personality testing and a new warning that it may do more harm than good. You can join the conversation tonight. Is personality testing a godsend for individuals, for employers? Does it clarify ourselves, our styles, our capacities, our needs? Or does it limit, confine, maybe even mislead? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight from New York, Annie Murphy-Paul, author of the new book, The Cult of Personality, How Personality Tests Are Leading Us to Miseducate Our Children, Mismanage Our Companies, and Misunderstand Ourselves. And also from New York, The New Yorker's Malcolm Gladwell, author of The Tipping Point. Sandy's calling right now from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Sandy. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make the comment that I'm not only concerned about the fact that these flawed instruments are less than objective, but there also appears, at least in my company, to be a trend towards some informal application by untrained personnel and informal interpretation.
So in the hiring or in assessing current employees? Where, Sandy?
In assessing promotional opportunities. And what happened in my company is that our managers all went away for a nice little retreat and had some training in the Myers-Briggs testing. I assume it was put forward to help managers figure out their own personal styles, but that became perverted, and pretty soon we were seeing the vernacular from the Myers-Briggs sneak into communications with certain of our managers.
And what's the problem with that in your company, Sandy, in your view?
The problem is that it is denying people based on absolutely no valid interpretation of a test that even interpreted correctly is not necessarily a real great instrument.
And you've got a bunch of people who spent maybe a couple of days with it now assessing everybody in the company on that basis.
Well, yeah, basically without bothering to even administer the test, as far as that goes.
Right.
I mean, when you start looking at the application of this across, you turn it loose to people who really don't have an idea what it's about, I think you're going to see a lot of perversion of what the tests are supposed to be doing.
Sandy, we've got it. Thanks very much for your call. Annie Murphy-Paul, there's a story right from the field. People get very enthusiastic about this. How does it get applied inside companies? Never mind hiring for a moment, but is it being used to decide who rises, who doesn't?
Absolutely. Sandy, your caller is correct that these tests, once they're out in the world, they kind of take on a life of their own, and the Myers-Briggs is particularly apt to be used in that way. A recent survey showed that 40% of personality tests given in major corporations are used on employees already in the organization. So not for hiring, but for team building and management development purposes, which can sometimes include promotion. So once again, these are important decisions, and they're important to the tone of the workplace, the way the workplace, the way employees are treated. And the tests are problematic to begin with, and then, as your caller noted, the vocabulary and the concepts of these personality tests kind of take on a life of their own and seep into the workplace culture.
Malcolm Gladwell, you spent a lot of time talking to American business people. Isn't this effort to type personalities almost inevitable in American culture? American business wants to slice and dice and categorize, and that's been the secret of its success in many ways. Isn't this, sooner or later, whether with these tests or some future tests, aren't Americans always going to be striving to figure each other out by some scientific means and in the search for what? Efficiency, for the best application of particular talent?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is something depressingly inevitable about this. I mean, we are, as Annie mentioned at the beginning, we're in love with all kinds of testing. We're in love with the idea that you can measure someone's intelligence by giving them the SAT. We're in love with the idea that you can, discover whether someone's ambitious or intuitive or whatever by giving them a 50-question paper and pencil test. I mean, we do have this kind of naive faith in our ability to measure things that are, a lot larger and more
complex than we care to admit. I think that and there's something about the culture of business as well that lends itself to this. And these are people who are used to, in other contexts, analyzing and categorizing and making very specific dollars and cents driven decisions. And so the urge to apply that same kind of thinking to human personality is nearly irresistible.
And yet I've known people who felt absolutely liberated by, let's say, the Myers-Briggs test. They felt that something, someone understood them for the first time. Maybe they understood themselves for the first time. Mona's calling from Boston. Hi, Mona, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks, Mona.
I have a different perspective on this, and so I'll tell you where I come from. I'm a French person living in the U.S., and a few months ago, Le Monde Diplomatique had an extremely accusing article on those tests as a way of taking away personal liberties.
Okay.
And however, what happened to me as an engineer getting promoted into management, I got a management consultant who came in with a whole set of tools, of tests, all the ones you named, and I took them, and he coached me through it. What I want to emphasize is the results of the tests were not that interesting to me as much as the guidance to be able to use a set of tools to understand other people. And so you guys are focusing a lot on the, if you will, the result of the test. What I think is more interesting is the framework it gives you as a manager to think about yourself. And I think that it doesn't replace your, as Sandy was saying, you know, whether you're talented or not for this job, but that if you consider what it offers in terms of framework of thinking, some of those tools have proved to me personally extremely useful in my new management role. So I just wanted to get you both of your parties here input on if an experience with guidance from a psychologist could help to put that, not focus on the results, rather of a set of tools for managing.
Right, and it feels like it's working for you. Mona, thanks for your call. Annie Murphy-Paul, how about it at this level of framework? I think for a lot of people when they first walk into the world of Myers-Briggs, there's a kind of magical quality to it. Oh, now I get it. Now I understand. Now I understand this person or that relationship. What about it as a framework? Never mind the individual results. What do you think of the credibility of the framework?
Well, that experience that you're talking about is actually so common with the Myers-Briggs that the world of the Myers-Briggs has a name for it. They call it the aha moment. It's the moment when everything falls into place and you understand yourself and other people, and all because of this framework, as you say, provided by the test. And I'm interested in what your caller said, because I think it's true that personality tests can provide an occasion for self-reflection and self-analysis that is all too difficult to come by in our very fast-paced, action-oriented world. My question is whether it's really necessary to administer a test with all its possibilities for labeling and simplifying in order to have that beneficial experience of sitting down, taking time to think to yourself or to talk with another person about who you are, what you want from your working experience, what kind of people you want to work with.
If you don't have a skilled psychologist or interpreter of personality at hand, is this an alternative for at least thinking about varieties of personality, or do you consider the framework itself flawed?
I certainly consider the framework flawed. I mean, astrology also gives us a way to think about who we are and what our future holds, but just because it offers a framework doesn't mean that it's preferable to the harder work of really thinking about who we are and what we want.
And I'm sorry, Annie, I interrupted you. You said you had a question that came out of this line of thought. I thought you were about to give us one. Okay, maybe I misheard. Malcolm Gladwell, Annie Murphy-Paul, I want to make room right now for Timothy Butler. He joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's a psychologist and director of the Career Development Program at Harvard Business School. His research on the relationship between personality and career has led him to the development of a test which is used by over 240 business schools and corporations around the world. Timothy Butler, thanks for joining us tonight.
Pleased to be here.
So you know the critique. It's pretty thoroughgoing on personality tests, pretty sweeping. You do a lot of work in this area. You've developed your own personality test. Is it a fool's mission? Is it something that just can't capture human complexity and may even trap people with labels in a misapprehension of themselves?
Well, Tom, I think an important issue here is level of abstraction. Psychological testing data by itself is information that represents an abstraction from actual lived experience.
Right.
It can be very useful in helping an individual model or understand his or her lived experience in a new way, but by itself, it has little meaning apart from that experience. And let me give you a very specific example. The students entering the Harvard Business School all take the assessments that have come out of my research, and often they come to seek me for career consultation, and often they'll begin that session by handing me their testing results. And I never accept them. I never begin a session that way. I set the tests aside and say, I need to know more about you. Tell me about yourself.
But in a way, you did begin it that way because they've taken your test, and presumably they come in with some kind of profile as a result.
Right, but it's the way those tests are used. Sometimes in our conversations, I feel that the information, the testing will enrich my students' imagination or help them to understand that there are underlying patterns to personality that can help them have insight, better insight into what we've been talking about. But I'm not in the business of interpreting tests. They do provide modeling. They do provide frameworks, but they have no meaning apart from the lived experience. The tests are only as good as the person who's working with the individual with them. And as abstract data, you know, they can be dangerous. And I think that business organizations generally are vulnerable to the making decisions with information that's at too high a level of abstraction.
Malcolm Gladwell, here's the argument again, that if you just do it right, it's a very valuable tool. It's when it's not handled well, when it's not understood correctly, that it's a problem. You were pushing back on that with our guest from Dallas, Texas. How about our guru from the Harvard Business School?
Well, I mean, I have two thoughts. One is that I agree with what was just said to a certain extent. For example, in my article, I talked about getting a what's called a TAT, a thematic apperception test,
yeah.
Which is an instrument used by psychotherapists as a way of beginning the analytic conversation. So a way of getting at some themes, which are then used and explored in more detail over the course of therapy. That seems to me to be an appropriate use of some kind of test. Now, the test itself is an extraordinarily subtle instrument as well and requires someone trained to do it. And so I'm not saying that there aren't things you can learn about somebody which can then be a kind of, you know, in a test format, which can then be the occasion or the beginning of a longer kind of exploration of who that person is. I think that's fine. That's why we go on dates, after all, right?
To check it out. Check it out.
Right.
We're squeezing the tomatoes.
Exactly. But my broader point, I guess my bigger argument about this is that I'm just concerned. Everything we know about psychology tells us that human personality or the expression of human personality is extraordinarily dependent on situation. And who we are in any given moment is much more influenced by our environment than we understand at the time or often care to admit. And all of this emphasis on testing is dangerous to the extent that it gets us away from understanding that people don't come in some kind of prepackaged permanent form. They are extraordinarily malleable.
Mm-hmm.
And as a business, instead of testing people and figuring out what slot to put them in, why not create an environment which brings out the traits I'm interested in? And that's, if you look at the really, really successful businesses, to my mind, they are those that create environments that allow people to be creative and ambitious and all these kinds of good things that we want. And they're not just selecting people who they think, on the basis of some ridiculous test, fit this predetermined profile.
Not trapping people in a four-letter code. Derek is calling from Plattsville, Wisconsin. Hi, Derek. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had an example. I've taken about 5 personality tests for a variety of different reasons, but
wow.
One of them that sticks out in my mind is I was applying for a sales position, a pretty high-level sales position with a company, and they gave me a test that was specifically designed to tell if I was a hunter-style salesman or a farmer-style, which is basically cut and burn versus relationship.
Okay, and what are you, Derek?
Well, what I did was, this is an example of why it's very important to administer the test correctly. This company allowed me to take the test home because they didn't want to take the time to have me do it during the day. It was pretty lengthy. So what I did was, I knew what they wanted. I went online, I researched the test, I took it, and I gave them what they wanted. And the results came back that I was the most phenomenal hunter-style salesman ever.
You weren't going to be sitting back waiting for the grass to grow.
Well, yeah, and consequently, they hired me, and I was miserable in the position, and I quit.
if there had been no test at all, Derek, and you had just sat and talked with them, do you think you would have come to a better understanding? You both would have ended up better off or not?
I think that the test had a major influence on them viewing me, and I didn't take the time to critically analyze if this is what I really wanted. And I think that if the test wouldn't have been there, or if the test would have been later down the line, we would have been able to have dialogue that would have gotten it out into the open that, you know what, this isn't for me, and I shouldn't be doing this just for the money.
Derek, it's a great story, and thanks for sharing it. Annie Murphy, Paul, here's a case where the test is becoming the fabric of the conversation. It's the intermediary factor. They're not really talking to this guy. They're just giving him a test and sending him home, and he's manipulating it.
That's right. I think in some ways test results are becoming a substitute for individualized knowledge of us as people. And your caller brings up an interesting point about personality tests, which is that many of them are very easily fakeable. If you've seen the Myers-Briggs, for example, some of the questions are so transparent. They'll ask a question like, I prefer to stay home and read a book or go to a party. And if you know that an employer is looking for an extroverted, you know, salesman type, then you're going to say, I like to go to a party.
Right.
And I think beyond the fact that this makes the tests even more invalid and unreliable because they can be faked, I think they also put us into an unsavory situation, sort of unsavory dilemma where we either have to lie and deliberately deceive the person who's giving us the test, or we may lose an opportunity to someone who's willing to do so.
You're sitting there saying, I know what they want to hear. So shall I tell them that? Check that box or be true to myself? And is this thing making sense anyway?
Yes. And any whiff of, you know, these tests are often about, enforcing conformity, trying to slot people into certain niches. So any whiff of independence or creativity or originality gets counted against you.
And yet, I have to say again, I've known people who felt absolutely liberated and an awful lot of insight from these tests. We'll come back and explore that with Timothy Butler, Malcolm Gladwell, and Annie Murphy-Paul, author of The Cult of Personality. You can join us tonight. Do we put too much faith in the apparent insights of personality testing? How much better is a personality test than a horoscope or a palm reading? Or have they helped you, your company, your marriage? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's love affair with personality testing. Annie Murphy-Paul is with us. She's author of the new book, The Cult of Personality. Malcolm Gladwell is here from The New Yorker, author of The Tipping Point. And Timothy Butler from Harvard Business School. He's developed his own personality test. Perhaps you've taken it. Are personality tests the modern-day equivalent of oracle bones and tea leaves? Could they actually be destructive, or have they helped you, your company, your career? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Kimberly is calling from Cameron, North Carolina. Hi, Kimberly. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I am a clinical psychologist at a men's prison down here in North Carolina, and we do use several of the personality tests.
On prisoners?
On prisoners, yes.
And for what, Kimberly?
Well, for them, it's primarily more of the clinical range to assess personality pathology, what you would call personality disorders. But really, what I want to talk about is the very low validity of most of these tests, which I believe some of your guests have mentioned already. In particular, the only two tests that are widely used that have serious scientific backing are the MMPI and Eysenck's Big Five personality test. The Myers-Briggs, in particular, I've always had a personal beef with because it has very little clinical validity. It's essentially based on the intuitions of the neo-Freudians as to what people of certain personality types in certain Oedipal stages would be like later in their development. And there's limited evidence for any sort of validity in terms of behavioral correlation to what the personality test tells you.
So you're the clinical psychologist. You've got a whole population of prisoners there. You do use testing, but you think a lot of them don't work. When do you find personality testing helpful, Kimberly? Do you sit down with a prisoner and say, well, here's your type, man. Here's what you've got to watch out for, or is it something else?
To assess their interaction styles, I should preface it by saying that we exclusively use the MMPI primarily due to cost limitations at the facility I work at.
This is the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory.
Correct.
Yeah.
And we are an inpatient unit, so we're dealing with severe psychopathology, and not the type of client you would see coming in with, you know, a problem with their wife or a problem with their children.
Right. But watch out, you say. A lot of these just don't have validity for you. Kimberly, thanks for your call. Annie Murphy-Paul, tell us the origin of the Myers-Briggs test. Kimberly says it hasn't got what she's looking for. She takes it back to the Neo-Freudians or Jung, perhaps.
Yes, there's a very interesting story behind the Myers-Briggs. It did originate with the ideas of Carl Jung, the Swiss psychiatrist Carl Jung. But the way the test itself was actually developed was that a Pennsylvania housewife named Isabel Briggs Myers came across Jung's writings in the 1940s and decided that she would create her own test. And now Isabel Briggs Myers was not a psychologist. She didn't have any psychology training. She had been put onto Carl Jung's writings by her mother. And together, the two of them, by testing questions, making up their own questions, testing them out on friends and neighbors and mm-hmm. their Isabel's children and her children's classmates, she developed the Myers-Briggs type indicator. And today, that test, which was developed by Isabel Myers, is given to 2.5 million people each year and is used by 89 of the Fortune 100 companies. So,
and you describe it as more or less, in a way, her own invention, that it didn't even really follow Jung's thought.
No. I think that she refers to Jung an awful lot and I think draws on his stature and authority, but she really departed from his own very humanistic and I think much more profound understanding of human personality, just sort of borrowing the prestige of Jung's name more than really delving into his ideas and his concepts.
Malcolm Gladwell, you reach into World War II history to illustrate very dramatically the challenge that personality testing is up against with the story of Sandy, and I don't know if I have the pronunciation, Nininger?
Yeah.
Tell us that story and how it put your antenna up about potential problems here.
Well, it's the story of the first person who won the Medal of Honor in the Second World War. It was a guy named Sandy Nininger, who performed an act of extraordinary bravery in the Philippine jungles in very, very early in the war, in 1942. And he was this person who, before he performed this act of bravery, was this very quiet, reserved, bookish, music-loving, thoughtful guy who, you know, when he talked to his friends, would always say how he didn't think he could, you know, really kill anyone and was opposed to violence and all these kinds of things. And
loved tea and Tchaikovsky and a good evening by the fireside.
Yes, that was his idea of a good time. And I read this, I just happened to run across this account of his life, and I was so struck by the fact that it was impossible to predict what kind of a soldier he was before he became a soldier, before he actually was in the jungles of Bataan facing the Japanese and, you know, confronted with all of the specifics of war.
And going with incredible fervor and valor after sniper, taking out the machine gun nests and all the rest.
Exactly. He was this,
And so it just made me think, you know, this task, this problem we're trying to solve, predicting people's behavior in real-world settings, is really, really, really difficult. I don't want to say it's impossible, but it's certainly a lot more difficult than the people who come forward with these tests will ever admit. And I just wish there was a little more humility in the minds of people who come up with these tests.
Timothy Butler, where is all this headed? We've just got a couple minutes left here.
Yes,
but
I would agree with Malcolm entirely. But, you know, testing for predictability is not the best use of testing. I think the very important issue is who is the end user of testing information and for what purpose is it being used? Psychological testing is best used as a tool that will enable a reflective experience. It is used poorly when it is used to create an abstraction of a person, and then that abstraction is used in place of the person.
But isn't that what most companies use it for today?
Well, I think in many circumstances that is correct, that the abstraction is used in place of the person, and I think that often does an injustice to the person, to the decisions that are made. But that is, in many ways, a misuse of psychological testing. Its contribution is in another arena altogether.
In 100 years, Timothy Butler, do you think we'll have more sophisticated, more successful psychological testing that will successfully match people and challenges, you know, mates, you name it? Or is this always going to be elusive in that predictive way?
No, my hope for 100 years from now is not that we have better tests, but we have better users of tests, people who are more able to understand an individual situation and help them to use frameworks so that they can understand it better. So the evolution that will take place will not be in psychometrics. It will not be in testing technology. It will be in the level of insight and ability in the users of the tests. That's what we can hope for.
And in the meantime, Annie Murphy-Paul, are you putting the brakes on this, or is this bigger than Annie Murphy-Paul's book? I mean, are Americans ever going to give up on such an alluring idea?
Well, that's a good question, because I think the desire to understand ourselves and other people is certainly an eternal human want and need, but so is the desire for a shortcut. People who use personality tests are looking for a shortcut, and when it comes to human nature, I don't think there is a shortcut.
Well, fascinating conversation, and I'm grateful to all of you for being with us tonight. Timothy Butler at Harvard Business School, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Malcolm Gladwell at The New Yorker, author of The Tipping Point, wonderful to speak with you. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
And Annie Murphy-Paul, author of The Cult of Personality. Annie, thanks for your research and your insights tonight.
Thank you very much for having me on the show, Tom.
Listeners, take it or leave it, you can try a personality test for yourself. Go to our website at onpointradio.org. Don't read too much into it, but you might find something there. In a moment, concerns over the new warnings against prescribing antidepressants to children. This is On Point. The Food and Drug Administration announced late last week that it agrees with an earlier finding that antidepressants can raise the risk of suicidal behavior in some young people. The agency will begin labeling the drugs with a black box warning, the strongest type of warning for prescription drugs. Some advocates, including the American Psychiatric Association, are worried that the new warnings may frighten doctors and parents away from treating depressed children. Quote, "We believe that the biggest threat to a depressed child's well-being is to receive no care at all," the APA said in a statement. Studies have shown that 2-3% of depressed kids may be more likely to experience suicidal thoughts as a result of antidepressant medication. One Massachusetts mother, whose 16-year-old son is on antidepressants, also worries that the new warnings may prevent kids who need the drugs from getting them. In this radio diary, she says her experience has taught her that to fear antidepressants is to risk peril. She asked that we not use her name.
Our son's depression didn't start suddenly. It crept in, slow and sneaky. He was tired. He couldn't get anything done. A homework assignment, a plan to meet a friend, it seemed like too much to tackle. He'd start something, get discouraged, and find himself unable to finish. His teachers were concerned about him and baffled. He just wanted to sleep. The psychiatrist we took him to diagnosed depression, recommended therapy, and offered medication. Our son said yes to the therapy, no to the pills. Things got worse. He was failing in subjects that he'd once enjoyed. He had no energy or appetite. Finally, one rainy afternoon, he sat in the living room and cried. I asked him if he'd had any thoughts about hurting himself. There was a long silence. Sometimes, he said. It was his decision to give medication a try. He said that the rare moments he had of feeling good made him aware of how bad he was feeling the rest of the time. We knew the medication would take a while to kick in. We waited. How you doing? We kept asking, trying to sound casual, mentally counting up the number of days since he'd started taking the pills. Good, he would say, trying to muster up the cheer we were so anxiously hoping for. Never mind cheer. We would have settled for normal, sullen adolescence. That medication never helped. Eventually, he and his doctor decided to stop that drug and try a different one. A week or two later, my son and I were walking down the street together. I said something to him, and he said something back. Something very funny, deadpan, lightning fast. Suddenly, for a moment, there he was, recognizably himself. Over the next months, he continued to take the medicine, and he continued to get better. Not overnight, but steadily. He started seeing his friends again. He ate more and slept less, and he found a few things to like about school. One night he was supposed to be home at 10, but he stayed out a lot later and forgot to call us. We were furious and thrilled. Finally, a textbook moment of 16-year-old boy thoughtlessness. What a luxury to feel safe about yelling at him. The news this week has been full of alarming warnings about kids and antidepressants. There have been claims that taking the drugs may heighten the risk of suicide in a small percentage of children. What I haven't heard much talk about is the risk of not taking the drugs, of serious depression that goes untreated. 13 years ago, my father killed himself. He was a man who took tremendous pride in his own strength and emotional dignity. He would never have gone near a therapist, and certainly would not have considered medication. He'd kept his depression so private that even the people closest to him didn't piece it together until after his death. Hindsight is never omniscient. You can't look back and say with certainty what the outcome would have been if a different choice had been made. I'll never know what would have happened to my father if he had taken an antidepressant, or what would have happened to my son without one. What I do know is that suicide leaves behind endless questions with no one to answer them. Why did you do it? Who or what is responsible for your death? Could anything have stopped you or saved you? My son's remaining grandparents think we overreacted by allowing him to take antidepressants. Adolescence stinks, they say. All teenagers are unhappy. Leave him alone, he'll outgrow it. They've been reading the stories in the newspapers. They think that by putting him on medication, we're playing with fire. I believe we'd be playing with fire if we didn't.
An essay from a Massachusetts mother of a 16-year-old boy. She asked that we not use her name. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.